Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Guests.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. This is episode 173, and I'm Paul Spain.
And I'm Brian O'Dwyer.
Great to have you here, Brian. A real privilege to have you on the show.
Thank you, Paul, and good fun to be here.
Now, for those who don't know you, where do you fit into the technology industry today? And I think just give us, you know, maybe what your business is, mm-hmm. and then later on we'll dive into a little bit of your history, because you've been involved in the industry for a long time.
Yes, I have a company at the moment called Computer Forensics NZ Limited, and we're involved in two primary activities. First of all, the field of commercial data recovery, and then providing a service for doing a paralegal investigation, which is computer forensics. And of course, forensics, of course, is where all the good TV programs come from.
Exactly, CSI and the like.
Yes,
all good fun stuff. Yep. Cool. All right, we'll look forward to diving into that as we get further into the show and hearing a bit of your story, hearing about your time spent with the likes of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. But to start with, let's jump into some of the news and bits and pieces that have been happening. Now we might mix this up a little bit in terms of what we chat through. But first up, I'd like to chat about Google, who have just announced in the last couple of days that they're slashing their prices for storing data in their cloud service, Google Drive. This is a pretty dramatic reduction in price, and for 2 US dollars a month, people will be able to get 100 gigs worth of cloud storage, or for 10 US dollars a month, 1 terabyte of cloud storage.
Yeah, well, you could
this
be...
This is huge, isn't it?
You could be forgiven for thinking that they're trying to push Microsoft off the table. But
they're always trying to do that, aren't they? But I mean, Dropbox has been the biggest player in terms of I guess the general cloud storage market that both Google and Microsoft have been trying to win a bigger share of themselves. I wonder if this will jeopardize the business model for Dropbox. I think Microsoft have got deep enough pockets; they can drop their price to anything. And in fact, Microsoft probably had some of the sharpest prices in the market previously to this with their annual subscriptions. And I think you were paying for 25 US dollars a year, you were getting 50 gigs from Microsoft. So I mean, what we're talking here is around half that type of rate. But of course, Microsoft were previously undercutting the others. But you know, Dropbox, we're told, may be trying to launch onto the stock market this year with an IPO, with an initial public offering. I wonder whether this means that their business isn't viable any longer. What do you think?
Well, I think you must be right, Paul, that you need something else. If you're bringing a new genre to the marketplace, it's almost like lifting yourself up by your bootstraps if you think that that's going to propel the whole thing forward. You have to have something. You've got to have cash behind you, if you don't have it, you better go out and do the old IPO thing.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see whether Dropbox does move ahead with that, whether they become an acquisition target because they've got that huge customer base. I think that it's going to be an interesting year in cloud storage, but I think it's exciting for consumers especially, because the capabilities we can now get in terms of various cloud offerings just keeps increasing, yet the prices keep falling.
Yeah, but do you not think that it can come to a stage that it's a very useful product for a company to have? But if you're not making any money out of it, well, we'll keep it there to keep the punters in, but let's go where the money is.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the likes of Google and Microsoft, they're taking a bigger picture, you know, type view on it. They probably get their profits out of scale to a degree, but also it's about having people on their platforms across the board, and some bits of their platforms won't be profitable or won't be very profitable.
And brand awareness, the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, must play in there somewhere. I mean, certainly there's a reason why Google give away, 15 gigs worth of storage just for being part of their ecosystem. Microsoft gives away unlimited when it comes to email storage with Outlook.com and 7 gigs when it comes to SkyDrive. So, there's certainly some advantage for them in having you within their world, as it were. So, yeah.
Or maybe again, Google's just been nice guys.
I think it's probably that, Brian. You're right. It's just trying to help everyone out. Yeah. So thanks, Google, for helping us out.
God bless you.
DigiLife. Now, this is an initiative that I actually just come across really in the last few days. Now, Telecom have got their digital ventures division, which is separate to Gen I and separate to Telecom Retail, that works, I guess, on sort of more entrepreneurial type activities, things that maybe don't fit within the other businesses or not just yet. And they've been working away on various projects. And last year I played with the smartphone that they loaned me that could do payments, had the sort of the integrated NFC payment system. And that was good fun, not something we've seen come to market just yet, and maybe that will be the case with more of their offerings. But DigiLife is one of the projects that they're working on. At digilife.co.nz the details for it, and what it effectively is to start with, they're setting it up as a trial, but it's all around the smart home, and we've heard this sort of smart home concept before. A home that's sort of connected and lets you control all sorts of things from your smartphone or some device, and taking care of your security systems and especially home automation and the like, potentially managing your energy usage and tracking it and so on. DigiLife is this play from Telecom Digital Ventures to get into that space. Brian, do you think there's much promise in this concept of the smart home?
Oh, hell yes. But I'm thinking the DigiLife thing, one of the fundamental things you mentioned, the alarm, the house alarm, as we move into VDSL, the question is, gee, what do we do about the old alarm system? Well, I've just gone through that menopause, I guess, and it was quite obvious. Do it over the wireless.
I think as exactly we move to sort done. Of yeah the naked broadband, yeah. You don't have phone line anymore. Yeah. Move to UFB. Yeah. Your copper connection for your old alarm gets cut.
It doesn't work.
And this sort of thing makes a lot of sense. And what I like about this is because and some others maybe that have been working on competitive offerings may not like is of course Telecom's got their own network, so they can produce something, and it'll be a combination of products that are being bought and various vendors, and then they'll come up with some sort of integration piece that brings them together, a smartphone app and so on. But the real crucial bit is they've got a mobile network that they can talk to. So what I've heard from discussions with them so far is that they really want to target this at anyone, not a technical person. So anybody will be able to get sent their DigiLife smart home set of devices. They'll put in these wireless things around the house and wherever they need to be. But you don't need to work out, you know, Wi-Fi passwords and other sort of complex things like that. It'll just have a SIM card in it and
but doesn't it seem like that way. You're going back to the past a little bit, because I've always thought, as I'm going to control my house and control this and control that, it will all be over the internet, because we're all going to be connected somehow to the internet, and so why not do all our communications over the internet?
I think it will be internet based, so they'll be using a cellular network, but really just to link it into the internet.
But
so
most folks are connected to the internet, and so why not do the access through the internet,
the whole lot,
rather than take a jump out there and say, oh, well, let's do it for the wireless, and then pop back in the internet again.
Yeah, good point. Well, maybe they'll offer both in time, and, you know, if people are in areas where they can get a good internet connection but not mobile coverage, that comes in handy and so on, but... And areas like surveillance video and so on that might not work so well over a mobile network. Certainly, as you get lots and lots of people on boarded, you can end up maybe using a little bit too much of your bandwidth. But it depends on how that works. So, yeah, I think this is interesting. Anyone who's interested, jump on digilife.co.nz. They have got a form you can fill out, which I think is just for a few more days, actually, to register for the trial. And I think they've already got they've already been oversubscribed by, I'm hearing, maybe even 10 to 1. But hey, if you want a chance to be on that trial, it's worth putting your name into the hat anyway, with the hope that that you may be selected to participate in the trial. So well worth a look anyway, just to get a heads up on what Telecom are working on. And they do point out that you know, this is a trial, and you know, they're not committed to a final product launch into the market. This is for them to test out the market and test out some product development and to see how it flies. So I'm hopeful that it will fly quite well, because I think it could be really cool. Now, a few other bits and pieces. We've talked recently about the news from Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, and obviously some new gadgets announced there as usual. Had a good chance over the last few days to spend some time with two of the new smartphones that will be launching into the market next year, Samsung Galaxy S5. Had about 3 days with one of the prototypes there, so that was fun just to get hands on. And at this stage, it is looking like a really, really cool device. I am quite pleased that Samsung have sort of jumped on board with the waterproof phone concept. It's certainly something I've appreciated about my Sony Xperia Z. That is really handy. Great camera. Got used to the fingerprint reader and so on. Haven't found a huge amount of use just yet for the heart rate monitor that's built into the Galaxy S5. But I know, as with all of these niche features, there'll be one or two things that sort of, you know, stands out for, you know, each individual will find things that they quite like. So, now, Brian, what's your smartphone of choice at the moment?
Ha, well, you're going to have a bit of a laugh at this. It's actually the HTC HD2. Which is probably 5 years old. It was running Windows 6.5 mobile, having a bit of a play around with it. You see, I believe a phone is for talking to folks on.
Yeah,
If you want all the other smart stuff, that's why God invented a tablet, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was running Windows Mobile 7, and then being, as I explained to you before, a bit of an Android bigot, I now have this five-year-old device running Android KitKat. A lot of fun.
Really do enjoy sort of tinkering around sort
Absolutely,
of software wise
yeah.
and loading on the different builds and so on.
Which I might say you can't really do that on an Apple, but there you go.
Yeah. You did make some comments like that a little bit earlier on before we started recording. Yeah, I mean, that was actually a really incredible phone from HTC. And, you know, I've got a couple of them that are still kicking around the office. And, yeah, it was a pretty impressive device when it came out. And, yeah, the fact that you could put, started with that Windows Mobile 6.5, as you say. I think people worked out certainly how to get Windows Phone 7 on there, and I think even Windows Phone 8,
yes.
It was possible as well. And then now you say, KitKat. And obviously other versions of Android that have been able to get onto that phone. So, a nice piece of work from HTC on that one. So, that's really cool.
But apparently, where HTC lost the plot, though, Paul, is where they stopped with that openness and they closed the whole thing down, and they apparently lost quite a bit of market share because of that.
Yeah, and I think the other point is that Samsung have just had such a huge momentum behind what they've done. I think that, you know, that certainly has hurt them. I've got the HTC One X here, I think it's called, which was the sort of the top HTC phone, 18 months ago, something like that, and a nice design, well built phone, but next to the it was the Galaxy S3 at the time. It was found to be lacking in a couple of areas. The particular one for me was probably the battery, performance in regards to battery. And, you know, they've gone to a more, what's the best way to describe it? You know, sort of all enclosed sort of device, a bit more iPhone-like, whereas Samsung have stayed down the track of a removable back and, you know, changed the battery and so on, which, as you say, it's...
I read somewhere where Samsung have 65 different models. Now, isn't that extraordinary? And I think if you want to sort of rule the world, that's probably a good way to start.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Apple go the opposite way, don't they? They have a small number of products, but they sell, you know, more of them than just about anyone else does in terms of devices. But
No, not anymore. No, sir.
Well, Samsung. I'm excluding Samsung. they do very well.
Yeah,
Samsung, because they're selling low cost up to the high end. Their sales figures are sort of off the charts in terms of numbers. But it is interesting, and I'm not quite sure what HTC's longer term future holds.
Well, someone said that they were going to be building the new 10-inch Nexus Mark II. Somebody said, mind you, somebody said that LG was going to do it. And Samsung was going to do it.
That's right, the new Google Nexus. Yeah. But nothing's really happened with that, has it?
I'm afraid not. I'm just waiting.
Now the other phone, and we'll talk more about the Galaxy S5 as we get more time with the device. But I guess for me, the camera also is an area that stood out. And I'd certainly like to have more time with that. But I also, alongside it, I had the Sony Xperia Z2, which we've got sitting here as well. And that's pretty much impressed me as well. Now, different, and I don't think probably there's any chance that Sony are going to get the broadness of attention or the sales figures. I don't think Sony are going to get those sort of figures when we compare it with the Samsung Galaxy S5. But still a real standout device, and the uniques on the Sony, they've got 20 megapixel camera, which they had last year, but they've improved some of the things around that. They've got their what do they call it, Steady Shot, which is one of Sony's sort of trademark things, and their handy cams and various video cameras, so they've built that in, and they've got some front facing speakers, which is nice from that audio perspective. And they've stepped up their waterproof, dustproof thing, although that's not a unique for them anymore now that Samsung are doing it as well. But a really impressive device overall, and 3 gigs of RAM, which is a phenomenal amount of RAM to have in your pocket in a smartphone. We're really talking a pretty high end device there with the quad core processor and so on. So some really impressive computing power that is really in this, even the current generation of devices, but it just keeps stepping up with each new release. And both of them running Android 4.4.2 at the moment in the builds that we've seen. And, of course, these products are still close to a month away. Galaxy S5 is out, I think, April the 11th, and Vodafone have the exclusive on the Xperia Z2, and I think that will be launching in a similar sort of time frame, probably mid-April. So, Brian, will you be lining up for a new smartphone? Do you see the need?
I guess I'm an old fogey on this. As I say, a phone, I believe, is for talking to. I'm going to hang on to this HD2 for a little while, but I want that new tablet, please, because that's got all the new toys in. That'll have Android Keyline. Was it? Keyline Pie.
Gosh,
that's the stuff.
Yep. All right.
These phones are toys. Tablets are real things.
Well, it depends how close you hold them to your face, you see. They become a tablet the closer you pull it towards you.
Yeah.
There you go.
But they are coming together, aren't they? Because what do they call them? Phablets? They're, 6-inch phones, is it?
That's right, yeah. And the 6-inch phones, really, really. And, I mean, even this generation with the Xperia Z2 and the Galaxy S5, the X5 5.1 inch screen and 5.2 on the Sony. I mean, these are impressive displays, and I think this continues to put pressure on Apple with their 4-inch display. That these bigger screens are just becoming more and more normalized every day. So, I don't know. I said last year I'd be surprised if the next iPhone didn't have a bigger screen. I'm still saying the same about the next iPhone.
Well, I think there will be one with
a bigger screen.
I think they better hurry up and get that bigger Apple out, because they will be left behind.
Oh, I think their profitability is still looking pretty good.
True,
if you're a shareholder, you don't have too much to complain about. There's a few other news bits, but I'd like to hear, Brian, from you a little bit, really about your background, your history within the IT industry in New Zealand. I've dealt with some of your firms in years gone by. I'm interested sort of where it all started, how you found yourself in the IT industry, and how it was that you found yourself meeting Steve Jobs, for instance.
All right. Yeah. Well, we started off. We had a company selling calculators all around the town, all around the country, in fact, and found that we thought there might be business selling high-end calculators. So I bought a store in town called the Calculator Center. I think it's now called the Computer Center, just down from the university there.
Right.
And that was going along fine, and we're selling these high-end Texas Instrument jobbies and the HP. And then the sales of that were flattening off. And I'm thinking, what is going on? And then someone said, these university people aren't buying them anymore. So I thought we'd better find out what's going on. And I went up to the hallowed ivy-coloured clad buildings and had a look around. And these people were using the thing called personal computers. And there was Tandy there and Apple and Commodore. And I'm thinking, this is probably the future. So I decided not to worry about the high-end HP and the high-end TI, but to start worrying about how I can get into this PC business. And that's exactly what I did. I wrote to Apple and said I'd like to come and visit them and possibly with a chance to picking up the franchise for New Zealand. And they wrote back and said, yeah, sure, come on. So stayed at San Jose, at the San Jose Motel. I had to go and see Steve Jobs the following morning. And so I was down at breakfast and I said, I'm looking, could you get me a cab? I want to go to Apple. And they said, well, where's that? In Cupertino, I think. So we all had a look in the phone book, and there it was.
Okay, yeah.
And so
they didn't know.
So the cab company found luckily Apple for me, and met Steve Jobs there. He pitched Apple to me, and I pitched my company, which at the time was CD Distributors, I think, and. Yeah, we had a great time. I found him a most personable fellow, actually. People talk about him being somewhat a bit rough. I suppose if you working for him is a bit different than
being
pitched to. Yeah. But anyway, so we had lunch and I left, and about a month or so later, I had this wonderful, it was a telex at the time, Paul.
Yes.
You know, isn't that so last century? But anyway.
You might explain what a telex is, because I imagine there will be one or two listeners that don't know what a telex is.
Well, it's like a typewriter that's being fed by electrical impulses from copper wires, something like that.
It's a predecessor to the fax, really, isn't it? In some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, a lot of people don't know what a fax is these days either. So.
No. And so then we did the Apple thing. It was most interesting because there was, of course, no software for the Apple. It was very much a private person's thing, but we wanted to make money out of it. And so I decided that about the only people who could really make use of it from a professional standpoint would be school teachers, because school teachers who know most everything would at least know how to write programs for the Apple and then make it useful in the school. So I threw one in the back of a little Hillman Hunter I had and drove up and down. I think I must have visited every single high school in the country and sold them Apple computers.
Fantastic.
And it was a great experience. We also established was then the first computer reselling chain. This was an exercise where I contacted probably 50 electrical retailers up and down the country and suggested they might like to try and selling these PCs. And at that stage, it was the Apple II, and I made one available for them at half price. And those that picked it up, there was about 12 of them, thought this is a really good way to make a buck. So yeah. I canned the rest. And we move forward with a very, very strong but small chain of computer resellers. Wonderful. And at about that time, we were doing so well, someone came along and said, would you like to sell to us? And I said, you mean you want to buy me? And they said, yes. And I said, certainly, because everyone ultimately is for sale. And but just before that, I had this wonderful experience of seeing that little tiny Macintosh. We went to an international meeting in Hawaii, and in the ballroom, there was about, must have been about 1,000 of us Apple people in there, and the lights were out, and suddenly these little boxes, little black and white boxes lit up, and there was Mac Write and Mac Paint, and the most extraordinary thing, and we all leapt up. It was a spontaneous wow, you know. That was my first view of Apple.
And
Of the Apple Macintosh.
Of the Apple Mac, yeah.
An amazing, amazing thing.
And what part did Steve Jobs play in that at that stage? Was he the showman?
He was very much the showman, yes, very much so. And it was very much his baby, loved it. But just before I left the Apple camp or sold it, we had a thing called the Lisa. I don't know whether you ever...
Remember that. So that was the forerunner to the Mac, I don't know if it became available here before the Mac or not.
It came out about the same time. What happened was that Jobs said to two groups of people, go away and make me a graphical user interface device. And one team came out with the Apple Mac and another team came out with the Apple Lisa. The Apple Lisa was a splendidly wonderful thing about the size of, 2 foot long by about, with a 7 or 8 foot, 7 or 8 inch black and white screen. A lovely machine, but sold in this country for $25,000.
Yeah, not a cheap piece of technology.
As opposed to a Mac, which I think sold about $2,000 at the time. So obviously the Mac took off and the Lisa didn't. But it's wonderful when you sell a $25,000 piece of kit, I tell you.
Yeah. So did you sell a few of those?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And in that case, we sold more leases per square inch than any country in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
So was that – how did you achieve
mind
that?
Mind you, that wasn't very many, but
yeah.
Because there wasn't much competition. But, we achieved it because, well, first of all, being a smallish company, profit was the thing, and there was so much profit in this Lisa, and it was such a wonderful thing. In New Zealand, a lot of early adopters, a hell of a lot in a country like this, there are a lot of early adopters, and to some people, price is not an option.
Sure.
And so they picked up the Lisa and ran with it.
No issue.
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah. And the Mac, how did that go for you?
Oh, gangbusters. Absolutely gangbusters.
And I guess that must have made then CED Distributors a pretty valuable company when someone came knocking on your door, because there was some good profits to be had across those products. Yeah.
But ultimately everyone has their price. And so left that and retired for about 2 years. And I wondered what on earth to do. And at the time, we were selling with the Macintosh. We were selling some Microsoft software, and so I thought, well, having done hardware, let's try the software thing. So I think it was 86. It obtained the rights for Microsoft in New Zealand.
A pretty small company back in 86.
Yes,
Microsoft.
Indeed. Yeah. But. What they did have, which interested me, they had all this DOS stuff, and I'd never understood it. That was the stuff that made the money, was all this DOS things.
People were buying Microsoft Word and buying DOS itself.
But coming up the street was this Windows stuff, and I thought, this feels like a Macintosh. And indeed, it felt like a Macintosh too. So we tried very, very hard to market the Windows product in New Zealand, and achieved once again, without wishing to be boring, we sold more Windows product per square inch than any other country in the world. Once again, because I was so infatuated with the Macintosh that now you could do this in this awful DOS world thing. Now you could do it and have a computer that really worked like a computer. So we went out and sold that one.
Mm.
But anyway, had a lot of fun with Microsoft, and Microsoft came, I think, in about 1991-92. There was a nice, pleasant, easy handover. Didn't make any money out of the handover, but made a lot of friends anyway.
Yeah, and tell me about that, about working with Microsoft, working with Bill Gates, doing business with him. How was that experience? You must have met him a few times.
Oh, I did, yes. The first time I met him, I was still had the Apple franchise, and Apple said you should go up to Seattle and visit Microsoft.
Really? Apple suggested that?
Yeah, Apple suggested that.
Was it Steve himself that suggested that?
No. It was just one of the folks.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I went up there and visited the managing director of Microsoft, who was a fellow called Vern Rayburn.
Okay.
And was talking to him, and in bounces Kid with sort of sneakers and hat on backwards and all the real stuff. And he sat on the edge of a table and swung his thing. I did not quite get the introduction correct. And anyway, so the
he didn't realise who he was.
No, so he's been. And so I said to Vern, God's sake, who in the earth was that? I said, he's going around like he owns the place. And Vern said, he does. But yes, I met him quite a few times after that. And once again, a pretty nice guy, pretty quiet fellow, you know. But no. Most enjoyable person. Yeah.
So, would you have mostly interacted him when you were with him when you were in the US, or did he come down here from time to time during you know that period of?
He used to visit Australia quite a bit because of there was Microsoft Australia. Mm. I think he came to New Zealand once. I'm not sure.
I remember seeing him when I was at Microsoft, probably 93-ish. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, apparently, he used to come down annual reviews.
Because he had a company here at that stage.
But during the time you were just distributing, I guess that wouldn't have been necessary for him to come down.
However, we still had to toe the line, even though we were an independent company, where we were essentially an ad hoc country sub. And we had to do what we were told. These reports will be then and that.
Oh, really? Yes. Right. So even though you weren't Microsoft itself, they wanted reports as though you were a Microsoft office.
Absolutely
in many ways.
So, yes. And, fascinating. The thing was that if you didn't do that, you had the feeling you might not be having it next year. So,
right. Yeah. I remember getting the wrath of one of the Microsoft employees, actually, because I think the day that Bill came in was maybe a public holiday or something, and there was on the floor that I went down to the door was locked, and I'd seen him upstairs, and then I was downstairs in the building in Simon Street at the time, and I was trying to work out how to get in this door. And you know, when you exit some buildings, you've got a button on the side that you press. So I went over to the side to look for a button. Well, that was the light switch for this floor, and Bill was in an internal room doing the review with no window, so I'd flick the lights out on Bill Gates. So that's my one Bill Gates story. That's really interesting. So when Microsoft came in, you'd been distributing their product for some time and done very well with those sales. So you must have built that it must have been a business that did fairly well for you up until the time you sort of no longer, I guess, sort of, you know, owned the whole Microsoft patch.
Well, you would appreciate, Paul, that when you are one of one distributors, that's a hell of a lot different to being one of five distributors. The fun goes out of it, as does the money, of course.
Mm.
But also, when I say the fun goes out of it, it means that you are no longer developing a brand, working on it, selling it, marketing, because what's happened is that Microsoft is in the country doing all that, and all you are is a time and place distributor. So you're adding little, if anything, to the pond at all.
Right, and people will just buy off whoever sells them the product the cheapest or has stock on any given day sort of thing.
It's a commodity. So what happens, of course, is the whole idea of cheapest is best comes in, so the distributors don't make any money, and it ends up with the retailers not making any money because, the consumer gets into part of this and say, well, I can get Microsoft Word down there for a dollar less and all this thing. So no one is making any money. And at that time, that's when you get out.
Yep. So you, made the good money when it was there to be made.
And honest Christian margins, I might add.
And how many people did you have working for you at Brymore at that sort of
About 35, 40. We had, that was Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch.
Yeah, because I mean, I remember dealing with, you know, with some of your people who ended up moving over to Microsoft. There was, I think, Mike Jones, Michael Howard, who's done very well as become a security expert for Microsoft, one of their top guys in the US, and Sean Dring, who worked for Microsoft here in New Zealand for many years, and all of those guys had spent time on your team before, I guess. You stopped, having a role for them, and Microsoft was able to, take them across.
But it's certainly funny when you look at the smaller companies such as ourselves, and then you look at the big companies. I think you're either a small company person or you're a corporate person. I certainly am not. I found that in my
The big corporate guy.
I guess not. And I found in the in the last year or so, when we were really humming as the Microsoft distributor and 40 employees, I just felt like a 24-hour HR director. It just, I had a staff.
Lots of challenges to deal with. That probably weren't as much fun as getting the business going. In the early days.
And so the company we have at the moment, sort of six or seven folk, including Maureen and myself, that's a lovely size.
Yeah.
We don't have HR problems.
That's great. Yeah. So tell me about the sort of things that you do now. And what are some of the more interesting cases you can tell us your company's called Computer Forensics. The forensic side certainly a big part of what you do, as well as that sort of file recovery.
Well, funnily enough, no. The whilst we started off and called ourselves Computer Forensics, we almost went broke, and we started off in 1999. Almost went broke trying to tell these jolly lawyers how important computer forensics was and how you could win all these law cases. They never understood, because that just wasn't the way they worked.
Right.
So just before we finally decided to, this is all too hard, I thought, well, the same skills that are required for computer forensics are required for data recovery. But what a different marketplace. Those people want to talk to you.
And they really want to get their data.
They really do.
Yeah, okay.
So we bounded on from there. And to give you some idea, it's probably the old 80-20 rule at the moment. 20% computer forensics, 80% data recovery. But we have a job on at the moment from a particular client. This is big. This is a big array of disks. There are 11 3-terabyte disks in each volume, and we have 3 volumes, so that's 33 3-terabyte disks.
This is the largest
by far we've ever done. And when you have faulty disks there and you've got to put that together, when we first started looking at it, you think, how on earth? And then I thought, you've got the elephant there. You just gently just gnawed him away, and that's what's happening.
Yep.
We're winning, but it is the most exciting challenge, really is.
Mm, that's a huge amount of data to recover. Yeah. So what are the sort of typical – I mean, that's an extreme
most
case.
Unusual,
but what might have happened – in a situation like that or similar to have led to this situation?
Well, what happens is, you've got, as with solid-state devices, disks are a very imperfect medium.
Very true.
I'm not quite sure where we're going to ever get a perfect one. Mm. Never, I hope, otherwise we'll have nothing to do. But apart from the cases where people are dropping their external USB and whatever, we generally find the majority of when it's non-physical is caused by bad sectors. Ultimately, every disk will fail due to magnetic plating problems, which is caused most times, I think, by some sort of electrochemical action.
Okay.
And, of course, that can attack anywhere on the disk, whether it's in your table of contents or your most important piece of data or so on.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we've got new file systems. There's a whole lot that's, yeah, I guess, changes over times, different RAID systems yeah. where disks are all blocked together.
Rules are all the same. It all comes down to one disk. That I mean, whether it's Linux or OS 2, bless it, or Mac, or Windows, they all have a file structure, they have a data area, and you've got to approach that in a very disciplined way.
Right, mm. and that's what you do.
That's what we do.
Yeah. Great. And you have how high a success rate do you get? How often do you get a situation where you can't get anything at all? I guess there would be situations where something's really, really damaged. Or
yes. Well, when you have a case, you obviously know of head crashes. What happens is that a head read write assembly will fail. Whether it's for some internal mechanical reason or someone's dropped it or whatever. But what happens is the read-write heads make continuous sustained contact with a disk that's going around about 7,000 RPM. Now, you can imagine what that does.
That's spinning pretty fast, isn't it?
Yeah, so that scrapes the all the stuff off. And you just can't get it back. Your data is gone.
Yeah.
And even though all the plating is not scraped off, if you just got rings etched into it, those rings are of such a height in magnitude in microns that the read-write head is unable to sweep backwards and forwards. So the read-write head can't check in. If it can't check in, it doesn't know what it is, and so once you've got rings on a disk, it's history. It's
right,
gone.
There is just nothing.
No way in this universe you can get it back.
So, I guess when people don't back up, that kind of helps you.
Yep. If everyone backed up, and not back up just once, Paul, you've got to back up twice, but don't tell anybody. That's right, because the reason why we're in business is because disks fail, and so folks go along thinking, oh, well, I'll just back this up, but that fails, so frankly, back up twice is the answer.
Yeah. Good advice there. And on the forensic side, can you share some stories? Maybe you might not be able to share the names behind them, but sort of situations do you come across there?
Once again, this extraordinary 80-20 rule comes into play. 80% of our business is to do when employees have stolen their employer's intellectual property. Now, and very often this happens because an employee has been there for 3 or 4 or 5 years, decides they want to go out in competition or go and work for another company in competition, and decides that all that intellectual property that they have created, well, morally it belongs to me, doesn't it? Not thinking for one instance that no, morally it doesn't. Morally and actually and legally, it belongs to your employer.
Well, it was probably the employer that paid them to
exactly
create the data
so.
And to build up the names and addresses in their database and so on.
So that's what 80% of our business is nailing these people. And what they don't realize, Paul, is when they're stealing this data and taking off and doing something with it, they are in fact committing a crime. It's theft.
And I don't think most people would sort of think of it
in
quite those terms, would they?
It is a crime, And so next time you think you want to steal some of your employer's IP, think about it that if you're caught, you'll never be able to get into America.
Wow.
Because you're a felon. Yeah. There's the other cases, of course, where we, you know, the distraught husband or distraught wife rings up and you've got all sorts of proof of assignations on the... No, it's that sort of business. Fortunately, we don't do much of that because it's a bit distressing, and anyway, they can't afford it. But a very nasty part of our business, and fortunately it doesn't happen very often, is objectionable material. I'm not talking about pornography here. Mm. I'm talking about, well...
The extreme end of the scale
I'm talking about kiddie porn, that sort of stuff. Fortunately, it's not as rampant as you'd think, but it is there. Mm. And we've had to report it probably about 10 times since we've been in business. Obviously, we don't spend our time looking for objectionable stuff, but when we find it, we report it immediately to DIA. We have to do that. And also, we cannot give them their disc back, because if we did... we would be guilty of distributing objectionable material.
Wow.
So what we do is we give the client back copies of all their data, and the original disk goes to DIA for their further whatever they do with it.
Wow. Oh, well, I mean, that's handy that you're able to be involved in that process. Mm. I'm sure it's not.
And it's nice to nail them, too.
You would pick. But yeah, if you've got having that impact, then that's positive. Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. Wow, really, really interesting stuff. And I mean, how often do these sorts of things happen with people running off with their employer's data and so on? Is it.
It's happening. In every town, in every way. Fortunately, being very skilled in data recovery, we can perhaps do a little bit more than the normal forensic investigator, because there was one case where an employee was thought to have stolen this material, and to prove it, we had to get information from a disk that had that was now an independent disk, but previously in its previous life was a server, and prior to that was an independent disk, and we had to go back three generations of use to get some data.
So it had been erased multiple times, reused in different
and we were able to get it. We couldn't get the whole document, but we had the string of ASCII text big enough that could show what needed to be proven. Exactly so. So if you're going to do forensics properly, you must be very, very skilled in data recovery.
Mm.
And, of course, data recovery means you must be able to repair hard disks as well, because if the bad person somehow knows that something's going to happen in the night before it goes whack on the hard disk, you've got to be able to repair that and get into it, which, of course, we do. We have our own clean room.
Wow. That can't be particularly a common thing for people to be putting hard drives back together and them work.
No, you actually have to do this because you're operating at micron level. And if you open up a hard disk in the normal room, the dust motes are big enough that they can impede the operation of the read-write heads over that platter surface.
Mm.
And normally we will not attempt to do data recovery on a hard disk that's been opened.
Right.
But it's that bad,
And the newest hard disks, you know, they're releasing the, there's 5 terabyte disks out now, and then there's the 6 terabyte disks that are helium filled to, supposedly to sort of reduce the friction inside the mechanism. Yeah, what's your thoughts on that? Zach, that would make your life difficult if you had to get it into a helium-filled disk, wouldn't it?
It really would.
You'd be a bit stuffed.
I think they're a little way off because they are pretty expensive devices, I think they are some years off, and by then the industry will have worked out how to do it. But if you brought one in tomorrow, I'd have to say no thank you, but no thank you.
Yeah, okay. So if you've got important data and you want to know you can recover it, stay away from the 6 terabyte helium-filled disks.
But I think the other interesting thing that's going on in the storage world is the whole business of SSDs, solid-state devices. From our point of view, they appear to be not a particularly good way of storing data. They have a finite life.
They don't last forever, do they? And I think you sort of have this feeling about, because it's some form of memory that, it's just going to keep working. There's nothing moving, so why should there be a problem?
But they seem, I don't know, this is just a gut feeling, but they seem to be more faulty than they should, which I suspect is why industry at large is not using these in any large capacity, no pun intended, any large capacity for desktops and so on. I think the reason for that is that, A, they're a little bit more expensive, but B, they're not as reliable, I suspect. But I think the very good use of them is using them as an operating system device where if they fail, who cares? You just get a new device and put the operating system on.
You don't have a lot of data on it.
So you've got you've got quick boot up and,
Yeah, well, there's the two types. There's MLC and SLC, and I think most of what we see at a consumer level are the lower cost ones. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can get obviously server based SSD disks. I mean, they're not physically disks. There's a real premium price on. And those don't have the same reliability issues that we see with with the consumer based discs. So yeah, I guess that's that's probably the difference. MLC being the what do they call it? Multi-level cell, and SLC being the single level cell, and that I believe is the one that's right up there sort of on the reliability perspective, but is so expensive individuals aren't normally going to be using them in their devices just so much.
I think you'd have to say, Paul, that the answer to the spinning hard disk is not the SSD. There is something out there that will take from the disks.
Certainly, their higher capacity end. There's still a big gap, isn't there?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Brian. I've really enjoyed our discussion.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. So, thank you for joining me on the NZ Tech Podcast. Now, where do people track you down online? You got a website?
Okay. Yes. A commercial. Thank you. www.data-recovery.co.nz and 0800 lost files 0800 567834. What a lovely number, 567834.
Nice. Well, it's obviously got a ring to it for you, because when it rings, it probably means you're going to be earning something. That's really good. Great to hear about computer forensics, and to hear about a little history of the computer industry in New Zealand and the part you've played in it. I'm sure across our listeners there'll be many that have come across you over the years, and others that have enjoyed hearing a little bit about what's gone on. So
good, thanks very much. It's been fun.
Well, that wraps us up for this episode. We'll catch everyone back again next week. You can find us online, nztechpodcast.com, Twitter, Facebook, and the usual social channels. And you can look out at globalvoicemedia.com to find out about some of our other podcasts, such as New Zealand Business Podcast and New Zealand Entertainment Podcast. All right, see ya.